This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson.
Oh, yeah.
We've just lost a bona fide legend, and at the end of today's show, we'll talk about David Bowie and his enduring influence.
Still don't know what I was waiting for.
But first, just last year, Alejandro Iñárritu's movie Birdman won big at the Oscars, getting awards for Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Cinematography. And last weekend at the Golden Globes, Iñárritu cleaned up with his latest film, The Revenant, Best Director, Best Drama, and Best Actor for Leonardo DiCaprio. DiCaprio's character in The Revenant is based on a real-life adventurer and fur trapper in the 1820s who gets attacked by a grizzly bear, and then things just get worse. Iñárritu is from Mexico. I asked him why he decided to tell such a quintessentially American frontier story with The Revenant.
The story of this country, as any country, you know, the foundations of any country, which is basically the story of humanity that has been repeating. And colonialism has been since the man is man.
Yes.
So I think in this case, this take place in 1823 in a place, you know, it's a part of the history that hasn't been explored too much, you know, in American films or even people doesn't.
Or American fiction or just in the popular conception.
And I think one of the reasons is because in that time, very few people went into this uncharted territory, right. This unknown territory. And all of these stories came out from these men, the ones who survived it. And they were these legends. And most of it came from these Eastern men, more intellectual guys who in a way romanticized the idea of these men in the woods and individualism.
Yeah.
But actually it was much more harder than you can read it. So if you go through the journals of all these trappers, it's really tough.
Well, as one sinks into the reality of this film, as one is watching it, you go like, really? You guys are risking everything and going through this hell for beaver pelts?
Yeah, but the funny thing is that beaver pelts was, in that time, the biggest income in the United States, more than anything. There was no oil, there was no gold, so that was the biggest business in the United States.
That's why John Jacob Astor invented Oregon.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was a huge business, and the way they came into that territory, it has a huge impact in the Native Americans.
Yeah, yeah.
And obviously nature. And so the conditions, most of these guys were young and they were illiterate and they were runaways, most of them. And most of them die in tough conditions by the weather, by animal attacks, by diseases, you know, and they got.
And you have all those in the film.
Yes. I mean, I think for me it was fascinating that in a way the amount of people from all around the world in that time with no law. And the way they were surviving each other, it was a surviving period of these men thrown in the middle of nowhere. And they were dying like flies every day of different reasons. And it's fascinating.
Yeah. The character, the Leo DiCaprio character, Hugh Glass, we never, other than he had terrible loss and he's out for revenge, we don't know what's going through his head. As opposed to, say, the Michael Keaton character in Birdman, where we hear everything that's going on in his head. And I guess you need a big star like Leo DiCaprio to pull that off. In a way.
Yeah, I think this film is show and don't tell. You know,
right.
It's a lot of no words. And I think I like the challenge to tell a story with mostly cinema. And cinema defined as image and sound and know a lot of dialogue. You know, is basically you are understanding everything by character's action and what you are seeing more than you are hearing. And Leo's character has very reduced amount of words, and that's it. The plot line is very simple. For me, the challenge was, who was Hugh Glass and what happened to a guy that has to survive in the winter for 200 miles? What is inside him? Who he was? Yep. What he was thinking? There's an emotional state that I want to, in a way, through images, to understand what kind of thing he's thinking, feeling, remembering of himself to, in a way, hold from life and get alive.
Right.
And I think that's the way when we are in a plane and the plane is getting badly, you know, you're a little afraid, suddenly a lot of images and a lot of things start getting into your brain. I want to understand this guy by cinematic things, and those images, in a way, try to recreate and a spiritual dimension of who this guy is.
At last year's Oscars, when you were raking in Oscars for Best Picture and others, you dedicated the Best Picture Award to your fellow Mexicans. Here's a clip of what you said that night.
I just want to take the opportunity. I want to dedicate this award for my fellow Mexicans, the ones who live in Mexico. I pray that we can find and build the government that we deserve, and the ones that live in this country who are part of the latest generation of immigrants in this country, I just pray that they can be treated with the same dignity and respect of the ones who came before and build this incredible immigrant nation. Thank you very much.
And of course, since then, Donald Trump and other people running for the Republican presidential nomination haven't gone the direction of granting dignity, but have hyped up this incredible level of anti-Mexican immigrant rhetoric. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think that, you know, always has been people that has been able to plant seeds of hate. What I feel is a little bit compassion about this, too, because it's part of the ignorance and that is based on fear and prejudice to find the otherness to be threatened, you know, and without understanding and without the ability to listen deeply to the realities of other people and see them as you, it's very hard when you compartmentalize and you generalize masses and said these guys are rapists and these guys are dangerous and these guys. So when you generalize like that, you are taking out the humanity, the integrity of a human being, of human lives. And that has been historically the case, and the way horrible things has happened to humanity, to millions of people that suffer and being killed. But it's coming from ignorance.
So really, you pity more than you scorn?
Yes, yeah. Because, you know, to be so rich and to be so bitter is a poor man whose only possession is money. And that is really, really, that's the lesson we all have to learn.
Yeah. You know? Have you ever had any thought of making a film about the American immigrant experience?
Well, in a way, I have to say, in Babel, I touch a little bit with one of the characters of a Mexican nanny.
The United States has deemed that you were seriously breaking the law and is determined to immediately and definitively deport you.
Sir, I've been here for 16 years. I have my things here. I rent a house. I made a life here, sir.
You should have thought about that beforehand.
Here, in a way, I think the revenant, the fact, you know, most of these trappers in that time, they relate with a Native American woman because those were the only women that were in the middle of the country. Most of them have families, but, you know, some of them reject them, some of them hide them, didn't accept them, or some of them really embrace the families. But it was a tough time. Slavery was, you know, normal.
Yeah.
And obviously the prejudice and the problem with the color of a skin and the threat that the otherness represent, very similar to today, was there very much. So when a trapper, a white man, related with a Native American and have a family, he was in a way always somebody to not trust very much.
In your movie, Hugh Glass, crucially, has a Native American wife and son, although that is not in the historical record.
He could have easily have a family that nobody knows. And I thought, what will happen if you have a mixed race kid in that time and you have to take care of it and to try to teach him how to survive under those racist conditions of that time? And me, as a Mexican living in this country and having kids too, you know, you are navigating all the time as an outsider in some way or the other. And that theme is interesting to explore, you know?
Yeah. You'd started production on this, on The Revenant, when you were accepting the Oscars for Birdman. And I've thought about the two movies, both of which I like very, very much. They're so different. I mean, here you have this period 150 years ago as opposed to now. You have out in the middle of nowhere as opposed to in one building in the city. Was that part of the appeal for you, too? Just like, whoa, this is 180 degrees different.
Yes. You know, I have never made a film in the exterior. You have never seen in any of my films any green. I hate to have trees in my films. Never you have seen a tree in my films. And this time I was surrounded by trees, which I have nightmares how to shoot a tree. Trees and nature is one of the most difficult things to shoot because it never – the complexity of nature is so much that your eyes catch it. But the camera and in a frame of a camera, you never get it. You never get the layers. So one of the reasons that we shot in the natural light at the end of the day in the sunset is because there's a certain moment in the day where nature reveals itself in a beauty and a complexity that in other hours of the day it's absolutely flat and horrendous.
Right.
So when you shoot it as a great painters like Caravaggio or Turner, they wait for that light to come and then everything just, you know, it's an ecstasy. The nature is in ecstasy. God speaks. And that's why I thought if I will shoot, that has to be in that hour because if not, it will look like a park.
Yes, so, yes.
And yes, I can put in CGI more trees or I will have shot this in green screen. Yes, too, but it will be another film that I was not interested, you know.
And you had bad weather, worse weather than you expected?
More than bad weather is weather.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not bad.
It was just winter.
Yeah, and you know, Calgary is the place in planet Earth that more weather changes in a day can be. So there can be seven different weathers in one day that goes from 20 to 25 degrees different. So it's crazy. So you have to be, sometimes you are God, sometimes you are a server of what you, your own creation. And we were surrendered to that and we have to adapt to survive to that.
Did you regret any of it? Or would you do, if I had to do it over, I'd do this and this differently?
No, I will not do nothing different. And that was the journey that we embark on and we sign on. And it's like when you go to the Arctic, you cannot expect to be warm. You know that it will be difficult. You will find ice. You know, so we knew what will be. Now, one thing is the notion of it, and the other is the reality. Now, that I expect to be so hard? No. Probably I will have not done it if I will knew. Now that I've done it, I feel so proud and so happy to have survived it because I could have died.
All bad things you survive are great in retrospect.
Exactly. But it was absolutely difficult, yes. But, you know, a lot of things has been said and discussed and whatever about how we all went through and how difficult production-wise and how much the crew. I have to say that I feel a little bit embarrassed of having discussed so much about that because that's our job.
One reason you've had to discuss it so much is because one of your crew members called it a living hell.
You know, honestly, yes, there's people that maybe it was not for them. And maybe one guy said, oh, it was a living hell. One guy from 300 for 11 months.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, that's good. But what I'm saying is, you know, it was a very tough thing, but at the same time, there was joy in it. There was joy in solving problems.
Did you on some level, did you want the cast to go through some version of what Hugh Glass went through?
Not that I wanted. That was the conditions that we were to. So yeah. I didn't have to remind the actors, you pretend to be cold. No, they were really cold.
Yeah.
And so all the elements, in a way, were there for them to be served and to be used. And that gave them a lot of awareness. And so it became a method acting, method directing.
Yes.
You know, and that was a privilege. That was a gift.
Do you have the next one figured out?
Not at all. I think the only thing that I need is like a bear to go into my cave and sleep for 6 months, I guess, and then find out what I want.
You and the bear thing. It's just all about the bear, isn't it? Alejandro Iñárritu, thank
great.
You very much.
Whether you say it correctly, thank you for having me.
Alejandro Iñárritu is up for a Best Director Oscar, and his film The Revenant is in theaters now. Coming up, in an academic discipline of the most humorless kind, Steve Martin found inspiration.
I was a student of philosophy, And there I learned about being absurd, which was essentially a little fallacy called reductio ad absurdum.
He went on to make one of the great and best-selling comedy albums of all time.
If there is a God, give me a sign. See, I told you that the Queen of the House in that will.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Last week, I announced a new creative challenge for all of you digitally inclined or just digitally curious listeners. Studio 360 has lined up two great judges for this challenge, and they are here now to explain everything.
Hi, I'm Heaven.
I'm Tracy.
And we're the hosts of BuzzFeed's podcast, Another Round with Heaven and Tracy.
So Valentine's Day is coming up. I know. That reaction is the reaction that a lot of people have, because sometimes it's hard to, like, give a good Valentine's gift. Because you don't want to do the whole, like, flowers and candy and a dinner thing. That's boring. Although I would accept any of those things if somebody's listening.
Okay, Tracy, come on. We're derailing.
But, okay. But, like, what is the appropriate Valentine's gift for, like, somebody that you went on a Tinder date with and you don't know the middle name, but you kind of know the last name a little bit and you don't know if they're crazy yet, but they're really cute, so you're down to see if they're crazy? Like, what is the perfect gift for Valentine's Day for that person?
First of all, that sounds so stressful.
Hey, internet dating is risky.
I think a GIF is a perfect present.
A GIF would be great.
A GIF.
Yes.
Rolls off the tongue.
It just so happens that we are teaming up with Studio 360 for a Valentine's Day GIF challenge. It's going to be great. You can find all the information that you need, including how to make a GIF, at studio360.org/GIF.
Do you think if you scroll past a GIF, it's still going?
Oh, my God. This is the new age if a tree falls
all
in the forest.
All this and more in our GIF contest.
Your entries to this Giphy Valentine challenge have to be in by midnight on February 1st, and we will have Heaven and Tracy back to announce the winner on Valentine's Day weekend.
I'm in the mood for love simply because you're near me.
That is Steve Martin back in 1978 on his stand-up album, A Wild and Crazy Guy. It won a Grammy and even hit number 2 on the Billboard pop charts. A Wild and Crazy Guy demonstrated that Steve Martin had command of the full comic spectrum, high-concept surrealism, as well as broad comedy that simultaneously made fun of broad comedy. Of course, if you're a fan of vintage Saturday Night Live, you know the name of the album is from a sketch he performed there. The Festrunk Brothers, two very 70s Czech immigrants with tight plaid trousers looking to swing with American women. To tell the story of the Wild and Crazy Guy album, we've got an historian.
My name is Sheila Motion. I have taught comedy at Northwestern University.
One Festrunk Brother.
I'm Dan Aykroyd, and I'm a writer.
And the other Festrunk Brother.
I'm Steve Martin. I'm a comedian, a musician, and an actor, and a writer.
Excuse me now. Let me tell your names. I'm Jortok Festrunk, and this is my brother, Jorgi. We're two unique guys from Czechoslovakia who ran from the Russian tanks to America because it's such a swinging and together place.
The Festrunk Brothers were Danny Aykroyd's idea.
Sort of one half his continental character and one half my Czech immigrant, and we fused them together to make the Festrunk Brothers. How generous an artist is he to do that?
Hello, Chief. Are you a 10?
I beg your pardon.
Don't worry, chicks. It's easy to score with us. We're hard up.
The Festrunk Brothers, they're fantastic because they're so outrageous in such a harmless kind of way. You almost feel sorry for them because their swagger is so big and they're so sure of themselves.
Of course, they pretended not to notice our bulges.
When he suggested the Festrunk Brothers, I immediately said, well, I have this phrase I've been using that's been working really well, which is Wild and Crazy Guy.
Because I am a wild and crazy guy!
Wild and Crazy Guy was my second comedy album. The first one was called Let's Get Small.
During this time period in the 1970s, we saw a great growth in comedy, and people like Richard Pryor and Cheech and Chong and George Carlin, and they were making albums, lots of albums. And so the comedy album thing, I think, was a very big deal at this time.
I'm happy to say I recently purchased my own form of private transportation, which we landed out here at the airport this morning. It's not easy landing a station wagon out here at the airport.
I loved comedy from by the time I was 7 or 8 years old. And I grew up watching Jerry Lewis and Abbott and Costello and Laurel and Hardy. But I decided at around age 15 that I wanted to be a magician. You know, I put together a little magic act, but then I realized that the audience likes it better when the tricks don't work. And I decided that I would try to lean towards comedy, and I began a slow process of eliminating the magic and getting into comedy.
Hey, I'm not trying to be a big shot or anything like that, but I get my drinks half price. That's right, for every one you buy, I get two.
At that time, my act was very, very visual.
So I can just have about as much as I want, you know what I mean? And it doesn't affect me.
He has a kind of gentle anarchy about him, you know, the way he disrupts the fourth wall. So he's interacting with the audience. In a way, it foreshadows some of what Jerry Seinfeld does as well, where you think about it for like a second. You know, there's sort of a beat, and then you think about it, and you really kind of unpack it.
Well, anyway, I guess you can tell that I'm into language, and language is kind of my thing, being a comedian, and... If you don't have a command of the language, nothing to be embarrassed about, but because this is my profession. And let's face it, some people have a way with words. Other people... not have a way, I guess.
Language meant a lot to me. I studied philosophy of language in college. And there I learned about being absurd, which was essentially a little fallacy called reductio ad absurdum. And I started applying that to areas where it really shouldn't strictly apply. But really, you know, theories are really good to get you motivated, but they don't necessarily lead you to good show business. You're constantly thinking, does this work? Is this working? Is this funny? But, you know, a theory can lead you places that you wouldn't have gone before.
I keep waiting sometime, you know. Oh. If there is a God, give me a sign. See, I told you that the...
He always pointed high. He pointed above the brows of his audience, you know, and somehow was able to connect with more intelligent material than many of his contemporaries who were kind of anchored in the real world. He was able to kind of soar up and away from the real world of stand-up. You know, what happened to me the other day when my wife locked me out of the car? That wasn't his humor. He went way high, intellectual, philosophical, absurdist.
Nah, it's so hard. It's so hard to believe in anything anymore. You know what I mean? It's like religion. I mean, you can't really take it seriously because it seems so mythological and it seems so arbitrary. And then on the other hand, science, you know, it's just pure empiricism, and by virtue of its method, it excludes metaphysics. And I guess I wouldn't believe in anything if it weren't for my lucky astrology mood watch.
He doesn't pander to any lower intelligence. He assumes that everyone knows. And everyone did know, of course, about King Tut, who was touring the country at the time. An Egyptian archaeological reference in a great song.
Now when he was a young man, he never thought he'd see people stand in line to see the boy king. How'd you get so funky? Did you do the monkey?
Of course, you never know what the impact is going to be, but the United States was coming out of a deep, depressive war experience. And also, along with that, there was a certain philosophy that was chugging along. You know, love child and hippies and free love. All that was about to change.
crocodile.
And I believe I sensed it or grew bored with it and decided to change myself and change my stage philosophy into one of pure fun and zaniness. And I believe the public was ready for that change.
They're selling you.
A Wild and Crazy Guy was one of 25 American recordings honored last year by the National Recording Registry at the Library of Congress. Our story was produced by Ben Manila for BMP Audio, and you can hear the stories behind other recordings honored, including Sly and the Family Stone's Stand at Studio360.org.
Born in Arizona, got a condo made of stoner.
Coming up,
Bowie will never die. Nothing will come for him in his sleep or charging through his veins. And he'll never grow old.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Kurt Anderson, and you're listening to Studio 360. The Boxer Rebellion is one of those historical events that you're supposed to know about. I'm willing to bet that you pretty much don't. And that's okay, because the comic book artist and author Gene Luen Yang presents the conflict in a terrific illustrated novel that was a finalist for the National Book Award. Back in the year 1900, Chinese peasants were fed up with the Western business people and Christian missionaries all over their country. The insurgency of the Boxers, as they were called, was quickly crushed by an international military coalition, but not before the Boxers killed 30-some thousand Chinese Christian converts.
It was like this ragtag army of these poor, illiterate teenagers from the Chinese farmlands who believed that they could call the Chinese gods down from the skies, and these Chinese gods would give them superpowers.
Talk about the characters you chose to represent each side.
Both of the protagonists are fictional. So the main character in the first volume is a boy named Little Bao, who grows up to become a boxer. On the other side, the main character is a young woman named Four Girl. She's born into a Chinese family, a traditional Chinese family that doesn't really accept her. And she grows up to convert to Catholicism.
And you were raised as a Christian and are still a practicing Christian, yeah?
Yeah, I'm still a practicing Catholic, yeah.
And given that you had a home team, did that make it hard to depict the Boxer side even-handedly?
Well, I think like a lot of Asian American Christians, I think I grew up within this tension between Western belief systems and Eastern culture. So it very much I feel like this book, the dual nature of this book sort of expresses an ambivalence I have about my own identity.
Your scenes in which the peasants turn into warrior gods are especially dramatic. The frames get suddenly large, the colors are intense, and the faces are kind of terrifying. The book became more comic bookish at those moments and less sort of graphic novel.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge comic book fan. I grew up reading comic books. I grew up reading superhero comic books. And that was one of the ways I found a connection with these boxers, with these teenagers from over 100 years ago. These young men, they first learned about the heroes of Chinese mythology through Chinese opera. So China has this long tradition of opera. And it's very colorful, it's very dramatic and very stylistic. And when I read about Chinese opera, and especially when I read about Chinese opera's place in these young men's lives, I saw a lot of connections between Chinese opera and American superhero comics.
Huh.
You know, both of these media, they tell stories about these heroes who dress in bright colors, who have superpowers, who fight these epic battles for the fate of the world. And in a lot of ways, you know how the way American geeks latch on to superheroes is sort of the way these young men in China latched on to Chinese opera. They felt hopeless and angry and they expressed their hopelessness and anger. They dealt with their hopelessness and anger by identifying strongly with these heroes that they watched on stage.
Well, and comic book superheroes are often mostly sort of navigating between two worlds.
Yeah, that's something that my Asian American comic book friends and I talk about a lot. There are a lot of Asian Americans involved in comics right now in every level of the medium. And we wonder if in a lot of ways we're attracted to this medium because we grew up with these stories of American superheroes. And every American superhero negotiates between multiple identities, right? So Batman isn't just Batman. He's also Bruce Wayne. So in a lot of ways, I think Asian Americans and immigrants, kids in general, we can find reflections of ourselves in these characters.
Yeah. You've written other stories about the tensions between East and West and immigrants. American-born Chinese is about a kid growing up in a San Francisco suburb, one of the only Asian kids in his school. You grew up in a San Francisco suburb, one of the only Asian kids in your schools. Am I wrong to imagine that American-born Chinese is wholly autobiographical?
It's not wholly autobiographical. It's fiction, but I did pull heavily from my own life in order to create that book. When my family first moved into the neighborhood where I spent most of my childhood, we were one of just a handful of Chinese American families there. There were so few of us that my mom actually went to the school and asked them for the addresses of the other Chinese American families. And then we went and made house calls one afternoon. We just went and met all three or four of them. Nowadays, it would be seen as something crazy, right? You wouldn't do that at all. But back then, because there were so few of us,
right,
that was an accepted thing to do.
American-born Chinese takes a kind of surreal turn when it becomes, for a while, a sitcom. And the comic relief is this character called Chin Ki, who's a caricature with buck teeth and very yellow skin. And he speaks with this extreme stereotypical accent. And he's supposed to be embarrassing. That is the point, which is part of what makes the book great. But did people at the time think, oh, my God, he's stepped over some kind of line of taste? Were you like, was it like Portnoy's Complaint among Chinese Americans?
That was definitely Chinky. Cousin Chinky was by far the most controversial part of American born.
So I didn't even want to say Chinky because that sounded more racist.
Yeah. I did that on purpose. I get three different kinds of reactions to Cousin Chinky. You know, usually from older Asian Americans in their 50s and 60s, a lot of them will get to the point in the book where Chinky shows up and they'll tell me that character made them feel so uncomfortable that they had a hard time finishing the book from that point on. And
yeah,
in a lot of ways, I feel good about that because I feel like that was kind of what I was going for. Then from other folks, other readers, usually Asian Americans who are around my age or younger, a lot of them will tell me that they found Cousin Chinky really funny. They found him really hilarious, but they felt guilty about laughing, and they felt really it was like they were laughing with a knot in their stomach.
Yeah,
and I kind of feel like that's good too, because that's kind of what I was going for as well. And then the minority opinion, the minority reaction that I get, every now and then somebody will come up to me and tell me, oh, you know that Cousin Chinky character? He's so cute. Have you ever thought about making him into like a plush doll or putting him on a t-shirt?
Oof.
And those folks,
yeah,
that makes me feel uncomfortable, you know, because that was not what I was going for at all.
That pickaninny commodification idea?
Yeah. My only regret for American-born Chinese is that I didn't exaggerate Cousin Chinky even more. Because I feel like if I had made him look even more monstrous, if I had made him look even more brightly yellow and more, you know, more exaggerated, maybe that final reaction would go away.
Yeah. When you're not writing about crises in cultural identity, you're also writing the Avatar, The Last Airbender comic book series. And I want to point out that that's different from the pretty terrible movie version from a few years ago. How did you get The Last Airbender gig?
That was an amazing thing that happened. I was a huge fan of that show. So Avatar, The Last Airbender, to my mind, it was probably the best American-produced animation show ever.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the writing in that show was just stellar. It was meant for kids 7 and up, but they dealt with all sorts of really complex topics like, you know, culture and the nature of evil, all sorts of things, family dynamics. Well, after the show ended, they announced that they're going to make a live-action movie based on the show, and I was really excited about that. Then they announced that M. Night Shyamalan was going to direct it, and I was a little bit less excited. I thought, well, you know, I liked his first two or three movies.
Yep.
And then they announced the casting, and in the show is set in a fantasy world, but it's a fantasy world based on real-world Asian cultures. You know, it pulls heavily from Japan and from China, from the Inuit cultures. But for when they casted the live-action version, they gave all of the major heroic roles to white actors. And to me, it just felt like yet another instance of yellowface, of Hollywood's practice of giving these roles that would most logically go to Asian or Asian American actors and giving them to white actors.
And then when did you start writing the comic?
The way I got the comic gig was I was so mad about this movie that I did a webcomic about how I was never going to see this movie because of this issue. And I put it up on my website. And one of the folks that read that webcomic was an editor at Dark Horse Comics.
Uh-huh.
So a few years later, Dark Horse purchases from Nickelodeon the license to do these Airbender comics. And because this editor had read this comic of mine complaining about the live-action movie, she knew I was a fan. And she contacted me and asked me if I'd be willing to write it for them.
Wow. That's one of the most gratifying acts of revenge in a cultural way I've ever heard. That's great.
Yeah, I was just very excited to dive into this world. I asked her, do we have to reference the movie at all? And she said, no,
yeah,
not at all. So,
you have that great gig. You've won awards. You publish widely. You still work as an administrator at a high school?
I do. Years ago, I was a full-time high school teacher. I taught mostly computer science, but I did some math and some art as well. And a few years ago, I had to go part-time, but it's difficult for me to imagine leaving that community completely or just leaving education completely. I think I'm just as passionate about education as I am about comics.
And does being this big comic book guy and graphic novelist make high school kids think, hey, you know, Mr. Yang, he's cool. He does these things. He's not just a teacher.
Not at all. I think it's just hard to impress teenagers that you see on a daily basis.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
It's hard to impress teenagers, I think, is a given in almost every culture.
Yeah, that's right.
Gene Lin Yang, thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Kurt. It was great to talk to you.
Gene Yang is the author of Boxers and Saints and American-Born Chinese. I talked to him back in 2014, and he's been really busy lately since our conversation. Just last week, the Library of Congress, yes, once again in this show, the Library of Congress, named him the National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. He is the first graphic novelist to get the honor.
Hello?
Hello, Gene. This is Kurt Anderson.
Hi, Kurt. How you doing?
I'm great. And more to the point, congratulations on this new appointment.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. I'm really excited.
So what is this ambassadorship entail besides, I don't know, ribbon cuttings at bookstores and libraries or something?
Well, the National Ambassador for Young People's Literature is a post that was started in 2008, so it's not very old. And the whole point is to get more kids reading and to get kids reading more.
So, Mr. Ambassador, how will you do this? How will you encourage young Americans to read more?
I really want to encourage kids to explore the world through reading, and I want them to explore in three very specific ways. Number one, I want them to explore the lives of people who are different from them. So I want them to pick books that have people on the cover that don't look or live like them. Two, I want them to pick subject matters, books about subjects that they might find intimidating. And my pet project here is to get more kids reading about STEM, about science, technology, engineering, and math. And then finally, I want them to pick books in unfamiliar formats. Nowadays, there's a huge diversity of formats out there. So there are graphic novels and prose novels and novels in verse and hybrid novels. I want kids to try all those different formats.
And have you taken your own advice? Do you say, oh, well, these people are not like me and I'm intimidated by this, but by God, I'm going to read it.
Absolutely. You know, I grew up not liking sports at all, mostly because I was terrible at it, you know, especially basketball. Every time I played basketball, the ball would find some way of hitting me in the head. Well, I eventually got interested in basketball, just recently, really, and books played a huge part. I started by reading this book called Outside the Paint, which was about the basketball scene in San Francisco Chinatown in the 1930s and 40s. I had no idea there was even a basketball scene in Chinatown in the 30s and 40s. It was an amazing book, and that led to me reading a whole bunch of other books about basketball and getting really interested. Now I'm actually doing my next graphic novel about basketball.
Really? Wow. And in addition to becoming this national ambassador for young people's literature, I understand, have been, I guess, to continue the basketball idea, called up to the NBA. That is, got a call from DC Comics.
I have said that before. I've told people that working for DC Comics is a bit like working for the NBA. Yeah. I've been working for DC for just under a year right now. I started writing for them in March, and my very first issue of Superman number 41, came out in June.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun. It's been kind of like the 12-year-old inside of me is freaking out about
sure.
this.
I can imagine. The last time we spoke, you were working as a high school administrator, and you said then that you could not imagine leaving education completely because you're so passionate about it. But you've left education.
I did. I left in June, and I left because of Superman. When DC offered me the Superman gig, I just couldn't fit it into my schedule. And it was so hard. It was it felt like I was breaking up with somebody. I ended up losing sleep for a couple of nights. I lost my appetite. It was crazy. But you know, I feel like, selfishly at least, this ambassadorship is kind of a blessing for me because it gives me another forum in which to connect with students.
Well, and I assume that your 16-year-olds who missed Mr. Yang certainly would understand, like, what? You're going to go write Superman? Yes!
Yeah, they were really happy for me, for sure.
Well, congratulations. And it was great to talk to you again.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Kurt. It was great to talk to you, too.
I was lucky to be a teenager when I was a teenager, 1970, 71, 72. So much great new music gushing through the pop pipeline, such a variety, and none more distinctive than this one English guy. His songs were perfectly odd. His personae were singular. Space Oddity, Ziggy Stardust, Diamond Dog. But it was relatively late, David Bowie, the stuff I was listening to in college, that really made me a fan. I was a young American.
We pulled in just behind the bridge. He lays her down. He frowns. Gee, my life's a funny thing. Am I still too young?
Then in the late 70s, he teamed up with my new favorite, Brian Eno, to make the gorgeous albums Low and Heroes.
Oh, we come to
And these days, I listen every couple of weeks to the Philip Glass symphonies based on those two albums. Right around the time the Low Symphony came out in the 90s, my wife and I were co-hosting a small party to celebrate a friend's book. That afternoon, Anne happened to meet Mrs. Bowie, Iman, who said that David was very interested in the author and could they maybe come to the book party? Amazingly, they did. And he was no sort of otherworldly diva. He was intelligent, gracious, funny, a hero who did not disappoint. And he was a hero to all sorts of people.
I remember, watching some 1980s music videos like Let's Dance.
That's the poet Tracy K. Smith.
But as I got older, I became really interested in the Ziggy Stardust era. I was probably like 30 when I became kind of obsessed with that moment. And I think what was so powerful about it to me was the sense of the imagination as something that is capable of creating a whole new world and a whole new sense of self. And I really have always just been so grateful to that.
She never met David Bowie, but his music had a huge impact on her. In 2012, she won the Pulitzer Prize for her collection called Life on Mars, after the Bowie song. And that collection has this poem about him.
After dark, stars glisten like ice, and the distance they span hides something elemental. Not God, exactly. More like some thin-hipped, glittering Bowie being. A starman or cosmic ace, hovering, swaying, aching to make us see. And what would we do, you and I, if we could know for sure that someone was there squinting through the dust, saying, nothing is lost,
that everything lives on, waiting only to be wanted back badly enough. Would you go then, even for a few nights, into that other life where you and that first she loved, blind to the future once, and happy? Would I put on my coat and return to the kitchen where my mother and father sit waiting, dinner keeping warm on the stove? Bowie will never die. Nothing will come for him in his sleep or charging through his veins. And he'll never grow old, just like the woman you lost, who will always be dark-haired and flush-faced, running toward an electronic screen that clocks the minutes, the miles left to go. Just like the life in which I'm forever a child, looking out my window at the night sky, thinking, one day I'll touch the world with bare hands, even if it burns. He leaves no tracks, slips past quick as a cat. That's Bowie for you, the Pope of pop, coy as Christ. Like a play within a play, he's trademarked twice. The hours plink past like water from a window AC. We sweat it out, teach ourselves to wait. Silently, lazily, collapse happens, but not for Bowie. He cocks his head, grins that wicked grin. Time never stops, but does it end? And how many lives before takeoff, before we find ourselves beyond ourselves, all glam glow, all twinkle and gold? The future isn't what it used to be. Even Bowie thirsts for something good and cold. Jets blink across the sky like migratory souls. Bowie is among us, right here in New York City, in a baseball cap and expensive jeans, ducking into a deli, flashing all those teeth at the doorman on his way back up. Or he's hailing a taxi on Lafayette as the sky clouds over at dusk. He's in no rush, doesn't feel the way you'd think he feels, doesn't strut or gloat, tells jokes. I've lived here all these years and never seen him. Like not knowing a comet from a shooting star. But I'll bet he burns bright, dragging a tail of white-hot matter the way some of us track tissue back from the toilet stall. He's got the whole world under his foot, and we are small alongside, though there are occasions when a man his size can meet your eyes for just a blip of time and send a thought like, shine, 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 straight to your mind. Bowie, I want to believe you, want to feel your will like the wind before rain. The kind everything simply obeys, swept up in that hypnotic dance, as if something with the power to do so had looked its way and said, go ahead.
That was Tracy K. Smith reading from her poem, Don't You Wonder Sometimes. And that is it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our team here includes
Jenny Lawton,
Andrew Adam Newman,
Louis Mitchell,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Lynn Levy,
Krista Ripple,
Danielle Fox, Affie
Yellerby, Kate Essig,
Zakia Gibbons.
And our theme music is by David Van Tiel.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, there's rock and roll about sex and drugs and rebellion, and now, thanks to musician Walter Martin, art history.
Just such a, probably like the least flashy, sexy thing you can write about is like a dusty old American portrait painter.
Walter Martin plays live next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Shark attacked Watson.